I give you Nick.
Thanks, Brandon. I'm Nick. I'm a heroin addict. Brandon took a little jab at me right there for the coat and tie because 2 days ago we had a conversation on the phone where I said, "Hey, by the way, I'm telling my story Wednesday. Do I really have to wear a coat and tie?" And he said, "Did you get the text?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Yeah, read it again. It says collared shirt good, shirt and tie better, coat and tie best." And I gave him several different reasons of why I thought it was stupid, and it separates me from the newcomer, and it's not me. And if you know me, I have strong opinions, and I will happily voice them. And when I get in a conversation with somebody like Brandon that also has that, it gets pretty interesting. So we ended the call. I said, "Okay, great. I'll see you on Wednesday in a collared shirt," and hung up. And now I'm wearing a coat and tie. And I bring that up because, what happened between when I hung up the phone with Brandon on Monday and me sitting in this chair wearing a coat and tie. And, we got off the phone, and lately I've been doing something where if something makes me angry or fearful because I don't understand it, my first question that I ask is what they're saying true? Is it possible that I'm wrong? And I'll usually go for a walk after that and kind of contemplate that. And, it really didn't take long. About an hour later, I knew that I was going to be sitting here in a coat and tie, even though my opinion on it was very, very strong an hour before. And typically with things like that, I'll run that by my wife. My wife's in sobriety too, and she's been doing this a long time, and a big part of our marriage is recovery, and I respect her opinion. And sometimes I'll start saying that, "What are your thoughts on this?" And she'll just blurt something out from upstairs, like bondage of self, and that's really what it is. The when I was able to pull back and see this situation for what it was, the same bondages that tell me I don't need to wear a shirt and tie or a coat and tie to this meeting are the same bondages that I had when I was getting high, and the same ones that I have today. They're the same ones that don't allow me to dance at a party because I don't want people to judge me, to embarrass myself. My stage character was the cool guy. I can't not be cool, and I literally lived my whole life like that. So anything that threatens that, I immediately get angry and defensive, and that's exactly what happened. But the cool thing is that I was able to recenter and see things for the reality, run it by a few people and ask that question, is what they're saying true, and go on a walk. And then now I'm showing up different, so I just, I found it interesting, and I thought it was funny. Brandon's busting my balls when he got on. He looked surprised, and here I am. But my sobriety date is February 3rd, 2017, and I am a heroin addict, and I love this way of life. I love this program. I got into a conversation the other day about, me being grateful that I'm a heroin addict, and I feel very strongly about that. And people have different opinions about that. I've heard people say that I'm not grateful that I'm an addict, but I'm grateful that I know I'm an addict. I agree with that too. But I am most definitely grateful that I'm a heroin addict, because if I look at how I was before I ever started using drugs, I was not a very good person. I was a sick person. I was a bully. I manipulated people. I talked behind people's back. I gossiped. I did all of these things. And if I wasn't delivered into the rooms of AA and introduced to the big book in this way of life, I would still be that person. So how could I sit here and say that I'm not grateful that I'm a heroin addict? Because all my experiences that I had, as messed up as they were, they led me to this way of life where I can show up differently. I believe very, very strongly in that, and I'm so glad that I was introduced to you guys. And then there was people here when I showed up to show me what this looks like and to demonstrate that for me. But as far as my using career, I think that I love this way of life that I live right now so much. And I really want to focus on the recovery aspect of this journey the last 7.5 years. I think it's important to qualify myself for the newcomers that are listening to know that my message does carry depth and weight, and we are the same. And when I say the same, it really just means that, you know, I have an allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind. You know, I suffer from the same illness that you have, and that shows up very differently throughout our using careers. And the way that I used when I came into these rooms, I thought I was unique. You know, go figure. I bet everybody on this call thought they were unique. They were different than the other people. And our stories are unique. You know, mine was a double life, 100%. I was not a gutter junkie under a bridge and with a brown paper bag, the stereotypical. I was a much different situation, which separated me from you, or so I believe. But I always think it's important to remember that what binds us together is this illness that we have, the allergy and the obsession. The allergy, meaning when I put it into my body, I lose control. I can't stop. I want more. And the obsession, meaning that when I'm stopped, I can't stay stopped. Period. You know, that's what qualifies me as an addict. And that is 100% true in my experience. You know, I mentioned that I lived a double life, and that really is my story. I talked about stage characters a minute ago. I grew up and sports was a really, really big part of my life, my entire life. And I had this reputation to uphold, right? And when I had an older sister, and she drank. She was 3 years older than me. So when I was in fifth grade, she was in eighth grade. And you know, I thought it was cool that she drank, and I didn't think it was a real big deal. And she gave me vodka for the first time. And you know, that wasn't the I had arrived part. It was like, you know, it's like, yes, I want to try it. You know, and then it started with friends. So it's interesting because when I think back to that in fifth grade, not only drinking for the first time, but smoking weed for the first time, I coached high school football for 7 years, the first 7 years of my recovery. And I looked at these ninth graders like they're children, they're tiny kids, they're so small. And I'm so naive coaching them, like how there's no way they could be doing any of this stuff. They're babies. They're so small. And they're ninth graders. I'm a fifth grader doing these things. It's just not normal. You know, by the time I was in seventh grade, I was smoking pot every weekend and popping pills and doing all these things with my friends. But it wasn't weird. It was just what we did together. But looking back, it's insane. It's crazy. That's such a young age to start getting loaded. And at that time, it that's all it was. It was just partying, you know? And I think the key there is that from before my sister gave me that first drink, I was open to it. You know, I was open-minded. There was no, oh my gosh, no, there's severe alcoholism in my family, you know, on both sides. This has been a problem for generations. There was none of that. It was like, you know, it's offered to me, I'm open to it. And when weed came into the picture, I was open to that too. Sure, I'll try it. And what I didn't know is my sister hated pills, but when pills came into the picture from somebody else that I knew in middle school, I was open to that too, and I tried it. Football was really my main sport. So when I went into high school, I was they were waiting on me to come up. You know, it's not, I wasn't like a prodigy or anything, but like they were waiting on me to come up and play high school football. So I go and do that. And my sophomore year, our starting quarterback got a full ride to Kentucky as a wide receiver, and I played quarterback. So they moved him to wide receiver, 6'4", 4'4", 40, move him to wide receiver and put me at quarterback on a 5A football team in the best region in Georgia. Georgia's the best state in the country when it comes to football. And I'm sitting here as a 15-year-old kid playing quarterback in a shotgun spread offense. And all of this pressure is supposed to be on me, you know? I was not fit for the job, let me tell you. I lost 7 games for us that year, but I didn't care. You know, you would think that there's all this pressure. I didn't care. My entire career in high school, I was the one in the gym in the weight room with everybody getting after it, where I'm in the corner checking the mirror to see if the coach is watching all my reps, just sandbagging as much as I possibly can, getting out of everything, you know. And that was it. I was too cool for school. Like I wasn't gonna do what you told me to do. And all along that time, from middle school to high school, I was a bully. I thought I was cooler than everybody. I manipulated women. All of those things, the stereotypical douchebag is how I lived my life for a very, very long time. And when I, at the end of my sophomore football season, I had just been grounded because my dad had found a bowl, like a weed smoking bowl, and I was grounded. And then New Year's came up. And by the way, I also had a ounce of weed with Percocet sprinkled on it, and I had never smoked it. But here I am, 15 years old, and or 16, wrapping up my sophomore year in high school, and I've got this ounce of weed and the Percocet sprinkled on it, and all of these things. And my dad finds this bowl, I get grounded, and they let me out for New Year's, and I went to a party, a New Year's Eve party, with all these juniors and seniors. See, that was the thing, is that I was a sophomore and I was in this role on the football team at a big school, and I'm hanging out and I'm going to parties with juniors and seniors, and that fed into the stage character more. But I was grounded. I've been on lockdown, and I go out and I meet up with these guys, and they take me to this party, and they walked me into the bathroom, and they laid out a line of Oxycontin about that big. It was tiny, and I said, "Yeah, I'll do it." So I did it. Because I knew I was going to be getting drug tested. It would be out of my system. I know I can't smoke weed at this party. I can't show up home drunk. So I do this line of Oxycontin, and it was just enough for me to feel nothing but want more. And I'd almost convince myself that, like, this is it. This is, I feel really good on this. It wasn't anything, but again, I was open-minded. You put it in front of me and I'll do it. The next day, I texted that guy. I said, "Hey man, where'd you get that? I'm still on lockdown. I'm back to being grounded. And I get this dealer to come to my house, and I get an OC40 from him. And I run out my house backed up to a park. I run out, I meet up with him, I run back upstairs. I'm in my room by myself, and I break down this OC40, and I did the whole thing at once. And if you have ever done Oxycontin, the first time you do it, you probably shouldn't do a 40 all together at one time. And I was crawling on my knees and throwing up the entire night. The entire night. It was one of the most miserable experiences I've ever had in my life. I was extremely sick, and I went to bed saying, "I will never, ever, ever touch that shit again. I do not like the way it made me feel." I was throwing up all night. Of course I'm going to say that. I hated it. And the next day I texted him and I got another one. So right there, it shows that, there's something there, right? There's a normal person says they're not going to do something, and then they don't do it. I'm already, from the very first real time, I'm saying I'm not going to do it anymore. And then the next day I get another one and I do it again. Now all of a sudden I like crawling on my knees in my bedroom and throwing up. That's fun. So I start doing that for a while. And football season comes up every day during summer. I would go to workouts in the morning, and then I would go back home, and I would steal $100 from my dad, and I would drive up a couple exits, and I'd go get five Roxies, drive home, do the summer deal. Next day, did the same thing. I ended up finding a cigar case in my dad's office, tucked away back in the fridge, of about $40,000 in cash, and hundreds and wads of hundreds. And I stole about 30 of it over the next 2.5 years. And I ended up setting up the maids to make it seem like they stole it. I ended up owing them an amends, and I made that amends. I got really sneaky with it. And this whole time that I'm in high school, and I'm this, the quarterback of this team and this stage character, I'm living this life. I'm living this double life because nobody knows. Everybody thinks I'm this person. And people know that I'm drinking and I'm partying and I'm manipulating women, but they don't know that I'm going to this guy's house in North Forsyth that has a he's selling dope out of his old school bus that's been run down for 30 years, and he sleeps in it in his front yard. Like, I was doing nasty shit or witnessing nasty shit and buying from this guy at 16, 17 years old. So it's much different than the other football players and the captains that I hung out with. So about the time of my senior year, I was fully blown addicted to Oxycontin, and I wanted to stop. And I got accepted to Georgia Southern to go to college, And I was like, this is my chance. You know, I'm gonna be, I don't know how to get it down there. It's not down there as far as I know. So I was really excited because I really wanted to stop and I knew that I couldn't. I don't know if I knew I had a problem at that point, a real bad problem, or you know, but I thought that if I was removed in a change of environment, that I would be able to stop. And so I went to Georgia Southern and I would self-prescribe Suboxone, and I did that. And I did that for 4 years. And it's interesting because I was snorting the Suboxone to make it last longer, and none of my roommates knew. I was very secretive the entire time. But I was also keeping myself extremely sick by abusing Adderall, snorting Adderall every day, smoking weed every day, drinking every day. All of these things were keeping me very, very sick. But I was able to live a normal college life in a fraternity, you know, just a normal frat bro. And I thought that I was relieved of this. I was like, I'm not a heroin addict anymore. You know, sure, my other things are questionable, but I'm certainly not a heroin addict anymore. But what I found was later on in my freshman year, when I went home for the first time back to Forsyth County, when I got on, if you've ever driven to Statesboro, you drive about 2.5 hours on Highway 16 and then you get on 75. And I got on 16 and I started driving about 100 miles an hour to get home. And then I'm calling this guy that I used to get dope from and I'm blowing him up. I'm saying, dude, you better be fucking outside waiting on me, just full on fiending. And I'm like, I haven't done it in 4 or 5 months. Where is this coming from? You know? And I found out later, I was able to put words to what I was experiencing was the obsession, and a very specific kind of obsession, the kind where you'll do anything to get it. It's not just, you know, a random thought or, hey, suddenly the idea crossed my mind. It was, get me this right now, be outside waiting for me, or there's going to be a problem. So that went on for 4 years. And every time I'd get on I-16, my foot would press harder on the gas and I'd be blowing them up and I would be telling them to be outside because I can't wait another second, even though it had been 2, 3 months since I had done it. And that was also about the time that I started switching to heroin and using needles. And by the time I got to my last semester in college, my fourth and a half year, I had 9 credit hours left. That's all I had to do was 3 classes and I could graduate. And at that point, I couldn't get Suboxone anymore. And I was driving back to Atlanta at least 4 times a week to go get a 60 bag of dope. So I would tell my roommate I'm going to the library and I'd make a 7-hour round trip to go pick up 0.5 gram or 1 gram of dope and drive back. And I was doing that 4 times a week. But what's interesting, and that was unmanageable, by the way, external unmanageability at its finest, lying, manipulating, lying to my roommate. But what's interesting is that every time I would go down there, the drive sucks so bad that I would say, I'm going to make this gram last the entire week because I don't even want to get high at this point. I just don't want to be sick, you know? And I truly believe that. I didn't like getting high, you know. I just didn't want to be dope sick, and I couldn't get Suboxone. So I'm gonna make this gram last the entire week. I'm gonna do a little bit so that I can function better. I can go to class. I can participate. I can go out and drink with my friends. And you know, it didn't last the whole week. It was gone before I got back, you know. So once I put it into my body, I wanted more, and I wasn't able to say no. I'm gonna ration it out for the entire week. You know, that's the allergy. So we're experiencing the obsession of the mind and the allergy all in the same day. And it's happening over and over and over. And I didn't know what was happening, but it led me to be so unmanageable that I left college with 9 hours left. And I moved back home to my parents' house. And I said, I'm going to finish online, which eventually took me two more years to finish. And that's when things got pretty bad with just everything, the lying and, you know, taking the 2-hour lunch breaks, driving to Six Flags every day to go get dope, and just putting myself in really, really unsafe situations in the bluff and things like that on a daily basis. And it's interesting because I had wanted to quit for going on 3 years, and I had looked myself in the mirror and made promises that I was done. This is my last time. There was actually a point where this was in high school. This is when I wanted to quit in high school, junior or senior year, where I laid out on my little, glass thing. I laid it out and I lit a bunch of candles on my desk as a ritual of this is the last time I'm ever going to get high. I really did. And it was like this big thing. I'm done. And I did it. And the next night I had a bunch of candles up again. I had the candles. This is the last time. But it's, that's what it was like. I wanted to quit so bad. I really did. And when I moved back home, I was still living such a double life that nobody knew. The entire time I'm doing this, nobody knew except the people that I got high with, maybe 10, 12 people out of hundreds that knew me, including my family. It's mind-blowing. It takes a lot of skill and manipulation, really good manipulation and lying to get away with that for such a long time. But what a gorilla on your back to live with, where you've got this secret. At all times, it's literally in the forefront of your brain 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and nobody knows, and you have to hide it. That's what I lived like for 7 years. So after a while, I had pawned a bunch of stuff, and I'd stolen everything from my parents and continued to blame the neighbor. Maybe snuck in the basement at night. I saw him snooping around and setting up the maids and all of that stuff until one day. My dad walked into the basement when I was working and he held up a golf club, and it was his golf club that I had just pawned at the pawn shop. And he said, "What is this?" And I said, "Somebody stole those out of my truck bed. Oh my God, I'm so glad you found them. They must have pawned them." And he said, No. He said, "What's going on?" And in that moment, for some reason, I broke the barriers down, and I told him everything. I don't know why. Maybe it was the day or the way he said it or how I was sitting. I can't explain it because I've been hiding this for 7 years, and I'd always been able to come up with an excuse or get out of it or avoid the situation. And this day, I just told him everything. I said, "I'm an addict and I want to stop so bad and I can't. And I need help, the bad part is that I was convinced that I just need a detox. I didn't know anything about AA. I had no, I probably should have mentioned this earlier. I had no relationship with God. I mocked people that were religious. It just wasn't a part of my upbringing whatsoever. And I truly thought that since I want to quit so bad, if I can get over the physical withdrawals, then I'll be okay. I want to quit, So I go to detox. He takes me to detox. I meet a guy in detox. I go in with the full intention of stopping. This is good. I want to quit. And I meet a guy in detox, and we ended up leaving together after 7 days and drove straight to the bluff and went on the worst 2 week bender of my life with this guy. Really nasty shit those 2 weeks. And 2 weeks later, I was back in detox. This time I didn't drive myself. My dad drove me. I went there. What's interesting is the first time I went to detox, I sat down with the counselor, and they try to get you to go to treatment and they get you to go to this and that. And man, I gave the best sales pitch of my entire life of how I didn't need treatment and I want to quit so bad and I'm only doing a little bit each day so that I'm not sick. Believe me, I can stop. I don't need it. I need to get over the physical withdrawals. And it was a fucking good sales pitch. And the reason it was good is because I believed it with every fiber in my being. I truly believed it. She probably didn't, but it was a good sales pitch because I believed it. And I ended up leaving that time and going straight down to the bluff and getting high. So the second time I go in, and I still didn't know anything about AA. I remember they brought an AA meeting to that detox, and they held something out, and there was this old couple, and they were talking, and they're talking about the big book, and I raised my hand. I said, "What are y'all? What is that book you're holding? What do you keep referring to?" And he said, "It's the big book. It's like the AA Bible." I was like, "Okay." So that was my first introduction to anything Alcoholics Anonymous, is that statement right there. What ended up happening is I went to IOP, and IOP introduced me to the rooms of HA. What's also interesting, I want to talk about this before I forget, is when I went to IOP and I talked to the counselor there, I had failed for 15 different drugs when I went and got drug tested the first time, and went and detox, and they had my report, and they were severely concerned about it. And I was saying, "No, it's not meth, it's Adderall, and it's not this, it's that." And it popped for a lot of different drugs, and they were concerned. And they sat me down in the room, and I'm going through with this counselor, and he said, "Nick, what do you want out of this? What do you want out of this process?" And I just said, I just want to be comfortable in my own skin. That's all I wanted. That's literally the only thing I wanted. When you live a double life for that long, being happy or being comfortable in your own skin is really all I wanted. And the reality is I sold this program short because I had no idea what it could do for me. I also sat down with the counselor, and he said, "What are you passionate about?" And I said, "Nothing." We're talking about what I wanted to do for a career and for work. And he said, well, let's start here. What are you passionate about?" I said, "I'm not passionate about anything. I'm really not." I said, "The one thing I probably am passionate about is football." And I started talking about my dream job being a high school football coach. And, that's kind of like always been in my mind somewhere. And he said, "What would it take for you to do that?" I said, "Well, I'd have to become a teacher, and that takes about 2 years to get certified to do that. And I might not even want to do it anymore after I do that certification." He said, "Are you sure that you have to do that?" And I said, "I think so." He said, "Well, why don't you reach out to your old head coach and just see if that's the case?" And it turns out that's not the case. I could be a full-time lay coach. And that's what I did, And when I talked about at the beginning where I'm grateful that I'm a heroin addict, that's one example of why. Because it led me to that counselor, which made that suggestion to take those steps and reach out to him. And being a high school football coach and the experience that I had in those 7 years was one of the greatest things I've ever experienced. It completely transformed my life, So I'm always grateful for that. But IOP introduced me to the steps. I don't think that IOP or PHP or rehab, I don't think any of that shit has anything to do with staying sober. I think it can be helpful being around like-minded people and different other things. But at the end of the day, I think it's just a finger that points you to God and to the steps. So I went to an HA meeting, and one thing that I'll mention is I went to this meeting, and I even asked the class. They're telling me about this meeting. It's called Legacy on Friday night. It ended up being my home group for 7 years. And I asked them, I said, "So what? Is it like a circle and people like get called on and raise their hand? I don't understand what exactly the format is, or like what you do." And they're like, "No, you don't have to share. You just listen and go in." And so I literally had no idea what the steps were, what a meeting looked like, nothing. But I had enough willingness to go into this meeting, and I walk up, and I'll never forget it for the rest of my life. One of my good friends to this day, it makes me emotional just thinking about it. And it's so simple. I walked up, I got out of my car, I was by myself, and I walked up, and this guy walked up, and he shook my hand, and he said, "Welcome." That's it. Joe DeFabio. That's it. I'll remember it for the rest of my life. So I think about that a lot at meetings because it meant nothing to him. It meant nothing. And it meant the world to me. It made me feel comfortable. And I walked into that room and I sat down, but I knew somebody now, So I when I'm at meetings now and I think, I don't really feel like going to talking to a newcomer. I want to go talk to my friends after the meeting. I remember that. And I go say hey to a newcomer because it could mean the world to them. It could change their life. It did for me. That night I also met my wife now. Well, not met her. I looked back in the corner of the room, and she was one day out of prison, and I saw her and I recognized her because she was my heroin dealer. and my OxyContin dealer in high school and my heroin dealer later on. And I said, "Is that Lily?" And I talked to her after the meeting, and that's what re-sparked our connection. And we ended up being meeting buddies for the next year. We're just best friends, going to meetings. I pick her up. We'd go to meetings for about a year, and eventually we started dating. And now we're married with a 16-month-year-old boy. We live in a house. You know, it's incredible. It really is. Again, you know, I talk about being grateful that I'm a heroin addict, that I was delivered into these rooms. These are the reasons why. It's so clear to me. My entire life is a result of me being an addict and being in this in these rooms. So I go through the steps. I get a sponsor, and you know, this is where it gets interesting, because talk about sponsorship. And my sponsor at the time was, he's exactly what I needed at the time. Exactly. Me and Lily wouldn't be together without him. He was like, and he was almost like a therapist in a way, in certain things. We went through the 12 and 12. I didn't go through the big book. I didn't know what anything in the third step, selfishness is the root of my troubles. The actor, God, my amends were, oh, they were, I didn't know what step 10 and 11 were. Nothing about watch ass turn, or, you know, it was so basic, but he helped me so much. And I experienced all the promises. You know, I had the willingness to go in the very first meeting that we had. And I didn't want him to be my sponsor, by the way. I got sucked into it, and I tried to avoid him, and I saw him at a meeting, and he said, "Look who it is. Let's meet." So we sit down, and he gained my trust like that. He shared his experience, and it was the first person I'd ever in my entire life been able to share my story with and be honest after living a double life for as long as I did. Told him everything. And from that point on, I told him everything. I had zero reservations in telling him anything because I trusted him. So I had an experience with that. I went on to sponsor people, and I was an incompetent sponsor. There is no doubt, which is interesting, you know, because I would sit down across from people, and I had no notes in my 12 and 12. I don't remember. I was so shot out. I don't remember half of it. You know, I took the action. I did what he told. I wrote inventory. I read in my fifth step. I made some amends. I did this stuff, and I got a sponsee, you know. And I remember sitting down across from sponsees and saying, "Look, man, I'm not a big book thumper. We're going to go through this in layman's terms," you know, because that's all I was capable of doing. Just talk out of my ass about something I had no experience, or I shouldn't say that. I had some experience, you know. I was 8, 9 months sober at this point, but I didn't know how to transfer that message to somebody else. You know, I didn't understand the verbiage in the big book and what they're actually talking about. So I did. I went through in layman's terms, and the first probably 40 people I sponsored didn't get sober, you know. And it wasn't until 3 years, 3.5 years sober, that I went to a big book study, and Dante and Tarek were running it. And they started talking about the big book, and I was lit on fire. I was like, "What are they talking about?" You know, they're going through the beginning of the book, and they're talking about things that I hadn't heard before. And I was like, "What are they talking about?" So I'd go up and I'd ask them questions after. I'd go every week. I'd take notes in my big book. I started taking people through the big book, sponsees through the, based off of the notes in my book from their big book study. I hadn't even been through the big book, you know, and I realized that that was a problem. And it was an even bigger problem when COVID hit and that meeting stopped. You know, now I don't have any notes in my big book. So, you know, what I did was I reached out to Tarek, and I asked him if he would take me through the steps. And you know, I've talked about this a lot, but at that time, I was able to digest what he was talking about when we went line by line through the book. Any earlier, I don't know if I would have been able to. I had the exact experience with my first sponsor, the time in between, and right when I met Tarek to go back through the work. And not only did Tarek show me how to go through the work, and he took me through the steps line by line in the big book to help me understand it, but he also introduced me to a network of people, Brandon Lasker and Sean and EJ. And we got in a steel on steel group, and I meshed with these people so well, talked to them on a daily basis. It taught me how to 10th step with people. I had never done that before. I didn't know what a 10th step was. So it taught me to do all of these things. And my recovery did a 180 degree turn. And I was happy before, you know, things were okay. I felt, the typical, oh, I just worked the steps and now I'm complacent and I'm stagnant. But life's good. How often do you hear that shit? And to me, my experience is I had a new experience with it and it changed my entire life. Changed my entire life. That's why I'm such a big proponent of reworking the steps with new sponsors to have a new experience. You just never know what's going to come. Not everybody believes in that, but how could I not when that is my direct experience? So I'm eternally grateful to Tarek for taking the time to do that with me and the relationship we've built since then, the relationships on the sponsorship meeting call, all of that stuff. It just the amount of gratitude and the way that I've been able to witness people and demonstrating what this actual way of life looks like is just it's incredible. It is night and day different than what I thought AA was in my first 3.5 years. It's interesting. I want to talk about I guess I've got about 10 minutes left. I want to talk about step 10, 11, and 12, and one more thing before we get off. But my first introduction to step 10, I had always thought it was what it says on the wall. We continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. But what does that mean? The steps on the wall are a summary of the book. So if you read pages 84, 85, 86, you start to see what they're talking about in steps 10 or in step 10. And it gives very, very specific instructions. It tells us exactly what to do all throughout the day. And aside from amends, which I don't think I'll have time to really get into, I think that truly practicing a 10th step not only brought awareness into my life after I was shown what my character defects are and what runs my entire life, the behaviors, the deep-rooted belief systems that haven't gone anywhere. Step 10 allowed me to bring God into that, because it tells us what to do. It says, continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When those crop up, we ask God to remove them. So that means every time I'm selfish, which I'm extremely selfish, I have to ask God, I have to communicate with God and ask him to remove it. That alone, much less the resentment and the fear and the dishonesty, that alone gets me talking to God 20 times throughout the day. So what we did in the 10th step with the assignment was I had note cards and I had a note card for 7 days that said, watch. That's it. I'm watching for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. That's all I'm doing without judgment. I'm just becoming aware of how much that's showing up in my life. And it was a lot. And it was the first time that I had been exposed to that. The next 7 days, it said, watch plus ask. So now every time I'm witnessing that, I'm asking God to remove it. The next 7 days, it said, watch, ask, turn. So now, if I need to discuss what's going on with somebody, I can. But now I'm turning my thoughts to somebody else. And that's really what taught me about a 10-step call and the importance of having a network of people, because it's not every time that I turn my thoughts to a sponsee or somebody in need. A lot of the times, what I'll do is I'll process it with somebody that I trust that can give an objective point of view. And then after they give me their opinion or their experience, I can say, okay, that's great. Thank you so much. How are you doing? I've never gotten on a 10-step call with somebody, maybe other than Tarek, Brandon, that I at the end of it, I don't say, how are you doing? And a lot of the times I do it with them too. But that's a very, very important question. It's back and forth, The part I struggle with is the cease fighting, of course. Because I go through that process and then I immediately grip it back and that starts the process over again. Another conversation with God, So I had an incredible experience with step 10. It honestly, step 10, I think changed my life just as much as anything else in this process did. And it's interesting because a lot of people don't know what the 10th step is. And it's interesting because it tells us exactly, word for word, exactly what to do, but it's so confusing. And it took me 3.5 years to figure it out too, with step 11, I have a lot to say about prayer and meditation and the pause. Meditation for me has been a very up and down experience. And the reason I say that is because once I started meditating, I haven't stopped. Right now, for the last month, I've meditated every morning for 20 minutes without fail. And the reason my relationship with it is up and down is because I fall under the delusion that I'm supposed to get something back. And I have this massive expectation because I've had that before. I felt that before, that connection. And now I sit there for 20 minutes and nothing happens. And I'm like, where's that feeling? You know, where's the inspiration? And I get really frustrated. And that requires a phone call. You know, I talk to somebody about it with experience with meditation. And they say, oh, yeah, me too. You know, and it brings me back to the purpose of what we're actually doing right here. And for me right now, meditation, it's really a time right now for me to let things be exactly as they are, you know, and keep it that simple. It really is. I've done meditation classes. I've done so many different styles of meditation because I do think it's important to keep it interesting. So that's why I say right now, that's what it is, because that's what I'm practicing with. The other thing with step 11 that I want to talk about is this idea of inspiration or intuitiveness with God, living with God. I had a career change about 6 months ago, and I want to give an example of how I bring God into my daily life and how I use that intuitiveness to make decisions. I was introduced to something called the two-way prayer, which is, you know, came from the Oxford group, or I was doing a variation of it where basically what I did, I was wrapping up my football coaching career and I didn't know what I was going to do after. And I wasn't worried about it. I trusted that something would come up. And I said, I'm gonna grind this out. I was miserable by the end of it. And I said, I'm gonna grind this out and I'm gonna finish strong. I'm not even gonna think about what I'm gonna do after. It doesn't matter. I'm gonna finish this strong and then I'm gonna spend some time in meditation. I'm gonna see what I'm gonna do with my life because the options are limitless. I can do whatever I want. And I sat down and I did the two-way prayer. And what that looks like is you sit down, or the way that I was doing it was sit down and you write out a prayer, a very direct question. Write out a very direct question. God, what am I supposed to do with my life? You know, guide me to what I'm supposed to do. And then I sit there for 2 minutes and I meditate on that question. I write down the thoughts that come into my brain during that 2 minutes. And I had a list of things, you know, and you kind of put it to the test. Is it pure? Is it loving? Is it kind? If it's those things, it stays on the list. If it's not, it gets crossed off. But somebody's name popped up on that list that I hadn't talked to in a while. And I was like, why is his name up? So I called him as taking action on the intuitiveness. Why did his name pop up? And I call him and he makes a suggestion. And I said, yeah, man, I really like that. And it's prompted me to call somebody else to get more information about what that would look like. And I call the other guy who I haven't talked to in 4 years. And he said, no, man, there's no money in that, dude. But what you need to do is this. And that's what I ended up doing. Is what he suggested. I hadn't talked to this guy in 4 years, but through a chain of events of that two-way prayer, I had a conversation with this guy and it sparked a new career for me. You know, I think that that is a perfect example of what God can do in your life when you trust, you know, and you spend time and you have those promises, the intuitive thoughts. I'm going to wrap up real quick. Sorry, Brandon. So that's one quick example of that, but obviously this stuff works day in and day out. I'm not going to talk about step 12 either, but I did because I want to wrap up and share something. You know, I think that the process for a newcomer coming into these rooms, the most important thing in your entire life that you can do is work these steps. You know, the working these steps is a formula that has worked for millions and millions and millions of people. Just go through the process. You will have a spiritual experience. You know, things will shift. You notice that shift, right? The ideas, emotions, attitudes, which were once the guiding forces of our lives, are cast to the side. A new set of motives and conceptions begin to dominate us. That is exactly what happened to me. And like I said, the first time I went through the steps, it wasn't perfect. It wasn't great. It was exactly what I needed. And I had that shift, you know, and I've stayed close. I've never drifted from this program the entire time, ever. I've always been to meetings. I've always sponsored people. I've always called people. And to me, that's what this way of life is, you know, and when it comes down into it, which has been on my mind a lot recently, is staying right in the center of the circle and triangle. It's cliche, but if you think about it, if you stay in the center, I think that you're in good shape. You're actively going to meetings, you're sponsoring people, you're being honest, you're working the steps, you're practicing 10 and 11. You're doing all of these things on a daily basis. When the thought or the idea that you're going to get high comes up, it's going to be so objectionable because this is your life. This is what you do every day, that it's going to pass right through. If you're not doing these things, if you've removed yourself from the circle and triangle, the obsession will come back. And I'm convinced of that today, which is a blessing, and just to finish it off, the today, I said earlier that all I wanted out of this when I first came is it was to be comfortable in my own skin. I really just wanted to be happy. I didn't want to walk around with this gorilla on my back and be envious of the lady that can just walk through Target on a Tuesday normal. I would watch that and I would envy them. You're normal. And I just had this gorilla on my back 24/7 all the time. I just wanted to get rid of that. And not only did that happen, but today I have some of the closest relationships in the world. This program introduced me to power. I pray, I meditate every morning. Like I said earlier, my wife's in recovery. We go to meetings together. We talk about God all the time. We have a 16-month-old healthy son. It led me to my career as a football coach. It led me to my new endeavor, my house, my car. My family loves me. I was able to repair the damage that I caused to all the people I stole from. There are so many moments that I don't have nearly enough time to talk about where God has just continued to show up, and it's incredible. So, thank you, Brandon, for letting me share tonight. Thank you, everybody, for being here. That's it.
Thank you very much, Nick. That was awesome.